Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Scott Kopetz, and to begin, we chatted about one of the most exciting new developments in the management of colorectal cancer, the use of anti-PD-1, PD-L1 antibodies in MSI-high metastatic disease. To illustrate this issue, I asked Dr. Kopetz to present a patient from his practice who typified the potential impact of this therapy.
One patient of note was a 55-year-old gentleman that had metastatic disease that presented with disease that was both in his pelvis as well as some very low-volume pulmonary metastases. As part of our routine profiling, we performed microsatellite instability testing and demonstrated that this is a gentleman that had a sporadic loss of MLH1, so not a hereditary form of colorectal cancer, but nevertheless a microsatellite instability high patient. Because of the potential for these microsatellite instability high patients to have a very large number of novel mutations, there's been a lot of interest in using immunotherapy with the idea that these novel mutations really represent new antigens that may help distinguish self from tumors. So we placed him on a PD-1 inhibitor. And this is a gentleman that had a fair bit of symptoms from his disease. He had some initial symptomatic improvement, but when we did some imaging on him after 2 months, there was a subtle increase in size in his tumor. And this is something that had been described with immunotherapy. The mechanism is felt perhaps to be due to a delayed response to the immunotherapy, but also the potential for the inflammation that comes with infiltrating the immune system to cause a paradoxical increase in size of the tumor. So we persevered, continued on with the therapy, and indeed he was then able, after several more cycles, to see some reductions in the size of his tumor. And this is a patient that then felt much better, so symptomatically certainly a substantial improvement.
And just to clarify, he received this first line?
Yeah, so this is a patient that had received some chemotherapy previously, but had not exhausted all available agents. And I think in this case, it was really based on some enthusiasm for this concept and some earlier successes that we had.
When was he started on treatment?
He has been on treatment for about 7 months at this point.
And I see he's receiving an anti-PD-1 agent, durvalumab. Can you review what we know about this approach?
So there is a series of gathering clinical experience. The first publication and presentation of these class of inhibitors in colorectal cancer was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier in May of 2015. And this demonstrated that there was substantial responses that were seen in patients with MSI-high colon cancer and other MSI-high tumors, and that this activity was not seen in patients that had microsatellite stable tumors.
How many people have you actually treated with a checkpoint inhibitor with colon cancer at this point?
So there's probably a general across multiple different agents. We've probably had experience between 1 to 2 dozen patients at this point at MD Anderson.
And what have you seen in terms of toxicity? Of course, it's been used a lot in melanoma and lung cancer. As you mentioned, less toxicity, but still some reports of autoimmune problems. What have you seen specifically in your own practice?
So this has been very similar to the experience that has been reported elsewhere. While there has been some concerns about potential for different toxicity profiles for the immuno-oncology products in different tumor types, I think in this case, it's not something that we have seen.
Can you talk a little bit about your vision in terms of, you know, why, you know, biologically these tumors are responding to this type of treatment?
So the best understanding at this point is really based on the idea that the microsatellite instability high tumors have a variety of mutations, 10 to 100, sometimes 1,000-fold higher number of mutations than is seen in garden variety microsatellite stable colon cancer. When we look at an MSI-high colon cancer or other MSI-high tumors, and compare them to many other different tumor types, they have as high a mutation load as is seen in melanomas and lung cancers, for example. So the idea, simplistically perhaps, is that the novel antigens that are derived from these mutations, the proteins that are expressed, provide a better avenue for the immune system to recognize this as a foreign entity. Indeed, for years, our pathologists have been telling us that the MSI tumors are really classically defined by a large amount of infiltrating lymphocytes. So before we were implemented routine MSI testing, our pathologists would call us up and to say, I signed out this case of yours and confirm the diagnosis, but I noted such a great amount of lymphocytic infiltrate here that I really think this is a patient that you should do testing for HNPCC with MSI. So this is finding that really makes sense biologically, that the immune cells, the lymphocytes are in the area, they're kind of circling the tumor, but they've not been able to effectively engage. And it may be this checkpoint that has been the barrier to really an effective immune response.
Could you talk about the different ways that MSI is tested, how you think it should be tested, and whether or not you think every patient with metastatic disease should have this at diagnosis?
So the field of MSI testing has been changing over the past few years. I think it's been kind of now two avenues and two reasons that we really should be doing more extensive MSI testing, I would argue, as part of the routine. One is that we are not as good at identifying hereditary patients as we would like to be, meaning that there are opportunities for intervening and prevention of family members, and that the family history alone is not always sufficient to capture those. So by doing routine testing, we do a better job. And then the second is this idea that we're now seeing evidence of activity with these novel immunotherapies. So the testing itself, there are two methods that are done. Traditionally, there's a PCR-based method to look at the number of microsatellites and their instability. This requires normal tissue as well as tumor tissue and is a little more laborious to perform. It's been now shown that the immunohistochemistry, actually looking for the presence of those four mismatch repair proteins, MSH2, MSH6, MLH1, PMS2, that those four proteins with simple immunohistochemistry staining can give a very close approximation of the MSI status. And so this is a test that can be routinely deployed in many pathology labs. So our practice now is to do the immunohistochemistry faster, cheaper, and better for screening. And we're doing this in all of our patients.
You mentioned that there are other tumors where this is seen. What specifically, which tumors is MSI high status been seen?
So the two largest ones are in gastric cancer as well as in endometrial cancer. But there are certainly other tumors that this phenotype applies. Small bowel cancers, for example, not very common. Some of the urothelial tract cancers also. And then there's kind of a smattering of other cancers where this has also been seen.
What about PD-L1 staining and correlations with response to therapy? What do we know about that in colorectal cancer and with MSI?
So we know less about that. I think the data has continued to accumulate in melanoma and lung. I think we are not planning on implementing this as eligibility criteria for many studies, just because this looks like that it may help distinguish some better responders from lower response rates. But nevertheless, we see responders in both groups.
Now, one of the great things about this type of therapy that's been seen with these other tumors is that many patients have very prolonged responses, some even unmaintained. What do we know about that in this situation?
So this is really the big question, I think, for colon cancer, because this is an experience that has been going on for a year and probably no longer for many patients. We don't have good estimates yet of how durable these responses are. And that's certainly the big question. I think there's also efforts to understand in those patients that do progress, what are the mechanisms that are at play? And I think there's going to be a fair bit of effort over the next several years really trying to optimize therapy for this population.
Do you think there's a role right now for the use of checkpoint inhibitors in these patients outside a trial setting? I mean, I don't know what the issues are in terms of actually whether you can access or get it paid for, but from a clinical point of view, have you seen enough that you'd like to use it outside a trial?
I think it's a great question, and it's certainly one where I think the proof of principle is there. There are a number of trials that are moving forward, both in first, third, and refractory line settings. So the hope is that here in the next several months, there will be studies available for any line of therapy for patients, although that, I think, doesn't always mean that that option is available for patients. So it is something that I think should be considered, but these are very expensive agents, and thinking about how to deploy these effectively off-label is a difficult discussion.
So let's talk about your second patient, the 69-year-old lady.
So this is a 69-year-old woman with metastatic colorectal cancer, and she has a microsatellite stable, KRAS wild type, but with a mutation in the traditional codon of BRAF, the V600E. She was treated with standard of care therapy. She received FOLFOX and bevacizumab with limited activity, and then went on to receive FOLFIRI and bevacizumab, again with limited activity and progression of first restaging.
Before you go on, I'm kind of curious today how you approach patients with BRAF mutations up front. It seems like maybe there's been better effects when you've used something like FOLFOXIRI Bev. How do you approach it clinically right now?
So a lot of it depends on the performance status of the patients. This is such an aggressive subtype of colorectal cancer that many patients will present with very bulky disease, poor performance status, and it's a difficult situation to tease out how much of that's due to the disease, how much of that can be salvageable with more intense chemotherapy like FOLFOXIRI and bevacizumab. So this is certainly a regimen that has been proposed as a reasonable alternative in this setting. And in appropriate performance status patients, we will use that typically after a kind of a first trial dose of FOLFOX and bevacizumab and then adding in irinotecan as tolerance has been established.
Again, sort of thinking about early on in these patients, any more reason to use an EGFR antibody compared to Bev?
It's a great question. There's been several meta-analyses that have looked at the potential impact of a BRAF mutation on response to EGFR inhibitors. These have been conflicting in their conclusions. My interpretation of the literature is that there may indeed still be a very modest benefit of EGFR inhibitors, but that benefit is just in perhaps prolonging disease control. It's not in added responses. And I think it really misses the point that these are such poor prognosis patients that the biggest goal should really be trying to get them on some alternate therapy. The average progression-free survival in first line is somewhere between 4 and 6 months for these patients. And then it's 2 months for second and third line, so first restaging. And so I think really understanding the biology of the patients is the most critical thing.
Do you consider BRAF testing standard in a patient with metastatic disease? And should docs be thinking differently about how to manage these patients right from the beginning?
I would. I would strongly advocate incorporation of BRAF testing as part of the standard panel. And I think many of the panels now that include the extended KRAS and NRAS will also include BRAF mutations. As a clinician, it's useful to me to understand patients who have a very poor prognosis. And this can help in discussions of goals of therapy and expectation.
Any other sort of phenotypic correlations with BRAF other than aggressive disease? What about age? Do you see it in younger patients?
So we'll see it across the age spectrum. There is numerically a slight predilection for an older female right-sided patient, but this is a mutation that can be seen in many different spectrum of clinical characteristics. And so I think the best is really routine testing.
So this patient seems kind of typical in the fact that she really didn't do very well with typical therapy. What was the next step?
So there has been very nice data that has demonstrated that the use of either BRAF inhibitors alone or BRAF and MEK combinations have not provided substantial benefit, at least not to the level that we see in melanoma, for example. And the preclinical data to ask the question of why that happened suggested a feedback loop to EGFR. So this very fascinating idea that even though EGFR may not be that relevant in these patients with BRAF mutation, as soon as you block the BRAF signaling, you turn on this signaling through EGFR. So you uncover this feedback mechanism. And so the preclinical studies and now the early phase 1, 1B studies have suggested that combining BRAF and EGFR can provide substantial benefit. And this was a patient that was then treated on a regimen of vemurafenib, cetuximab, and irinotecan. And it's a patient that had very nice response to the regimen. I had some tumor regression for the first time in her treatment course with a partial response. And then disease was stabilized for approximately 8 months.
So can you talk a little bit more? Actually, as you were talking about that biology, I was just thinking, I mean, V600E mutations, in my naive mind, is a V600E mutation. Why it is that these tumors have this other feedback and, you know, you don't see it in melanoma or even lung cancer?
It's been an important lesson for us in the field of targeted therapy. We're hopeful several years ago that we would be able to stop thinking about the tumor of origin and really just think about the molecular phenotype of the tumor. But it's clear that these mutations occur in a different molecular context, and they occur in cells that are already predisposed and wired in a certain way. EGFR is not a critical signaling pathway in melanoma, and these cells in colorectal cancer appear really to be poised and wired to make use of this as a feedback mechanism. I think what we're seeing is this single digit to low 10% response rate with the BRAF or BRAF plus MEK inhibitor strategy. Now with using BRAF and EGFR combinations, we see response rates up into the 20% in some studies. And then some of the triplet combinations, such as the BRAF-EGFR-irinotecan combination that I mentioned for this patient, where we see response rates up into 30-40%. And similarly with the BRAF-MEK-EGFR triplet, seeing these levels of high activity.
I'm just trying to even grasp what must happen to the skin. In melanoma, it's kind of tricky figuring out what happens once you bring in a MEK inhibitor. Sometimes you see less of one thing and more of another, fevers, et cetera. Now you're bringing EGFR antibodies. What happened with this patient, and what do you typically see when you start bringing in, you know, EGFR antibody and these BRAF inhibitors?
So fortunately, what we see is a fairly tolerable rash. Numbers are still a little too small to see whether we are actually mitigating the effect of the rash, but certainly there does not appear to be an exacerbation of the traditional cetuximab skin rash. There are differences in some of the skin effects from the BRAF inhibitor, depending on whether it's a single agent BRAF or a BRAF-MEK combination with some of the keratoacanthomas or the squamous cell cancers of the skin that can occur.
So let's go into your next case, a 68-year-old man.
Certainly. So this is a 68-year-old man with a KRAS mutant colorectal cancer that was fairly typical course, FOLFOX, bevacizumab, perhaps had a little less response than one would expect, but were able to de-escalate to a maintenance 5-FU and bevacizumab, and then the patient had progressed. He did have some residual neuropathy at that time, not severe, but enough that we opted to go on to a second-line therapy of FOLFIRI and bevacizumab. He had some stability for several months and then unfortunately had progression of disease.
Before you continue, I'm curious how you approach second-line therapy in patients who receive FOLFOX-BEV, which is certainly the most common initial approach. There are now several options in continuing bevacizumab and switching to chemo, which is what most people do and what you did, but also aflibercept and more recently ramucirumab. How do you compare those three approaches?
So this is an area that is indeed a fascinating area to understand, and I think we have less understanding of the biology and probably less clarity in the clinical decision-making than we'd like. The fundamental premise behind these decisions is really that bevacizumab is not particularly active as a single agent. And we know that from several studies in colorectal cancer, but it does potentiate chemotherapy. When we see a patient that is progressing on chemotherapy, The question is it a progression on the cytotoxic component of the regimen? And is that associated also with a resistant to the angiogenesis inhibition? And at this point, we really don't have a good way of understanding who is resistant to that anti-angiogenic effect. The second question then is, are these other alternatives to bevacizumab, zivafibrocept, ramucirumab, that have a slightly different spectrum of anti-angiogenic activity, are those able to rescue some of the resistance that may be developing to bevacizumab? And this remains a hypothetical and is not something that we have good clinical data. There's been efforts to try to understand biomarkers, but those are still ongoing and we don't have clear answers. So at this point, the cross-trial comparisons really suggest a very similar pattern between those. And so I think it's certainly very reasonable to use any of the anti-angiogenic agents in the second line setting.
In patients like this one with a KRAS mutant disease where an EGFR antibody is not going to be a consideration, do you approach the second line decision differently in a patient who's had relatively poor response and rapid progression as opposed to a patient who maybe had a good response and slow progression?
It's a certainly very interesting point, and I think I've certainly have colleagues who do practice in that manner that try to be more likely to switch agents in the setting of a below average initial response. And I think it's certainly an area that we should be exploring. I think the clinical data that we've seen has not always been as clear in this area. And I think my personal practice tends to be more based on the tolerance and the toxicity profile differences between the different anti-angiogenic agents in second line.
What is your perception of the difference in tolerance?
So there have been, in kind of the experiences that we've been accumulating and treating these patients with the different agents, the toxicity profile of zivafibrocept and ramucirumab certainly reflect that the mechanism of action is slightly different. As an example, we see higher rates of GI toxicity with zivafibrocept, and this actually aligns well with the biology. So one of the things zivafibrocept does, besides blocking the VEGF-A signaling, is also blocks one of the other VEGF family members, placental growth factor. And we know from mouse models that placental growth factor may or may not be relevant in tumor angiogenesis, but it's very relevant for repair of the GI mucosal lining. So after an injury to the GI tract, placental growth factor is used to help repair. And so this is actually an on-target toxicity to see a greater rate of GI toxicity in combination with irinotecan.
So what happened with this man?
So this gentleman was then initiated on regorafenib. We had discussed at that point a rechallenge with FOLFOX, and this is a common discussion point I have with patients at this point. He, again, had not progressed on FOLFOX. We had stopped the oxaliplatin component due to his toxicity. And the discussion was really around how are the nerves doing, how's the neuropathy. And in this patient, we'd opted to proceed on with regorafenib to give the nerves a little more time to heal. As many are recommending, we started at the 120 milligram dose of regorafenib instead of the labeled 160 milligrams. With the idea that if a patient tolerates it well, you can escalate up to the 160 milligrams. But his tolerance was modest, most of the symptoms kind of accumulating towards the end of his cycle. Fatigue was the most prominent in his case, and we felt that he would not benefit additionally from increasing the dose to 160. So unfortunately, he had, as many of the patients on regorafenib, had disease progression at 2 months and was then taken off the regorafenib.
Can you talk a little bit about TAS-102 as another agent that's being considered, I guess, for possible approval and use? What is TAS-102? What do we know about it? And how does that compare data-wise to regorafenib?
All right. So TAS-102 is an agent that we indeed are hopeful based on randomized phase 3 data comparing it to best supportive care, demonstrated an overall survival improvement. We're anticipating and hopeful that that will indeed be approved and be an option for our patients. When you compare the curves, again, cross-trial comparisons of regorafenib and TAS-102, they look very similar. And that does mean that unfortunately most patients are not benefiting from the therapy, but there is a subset that derives some stability of disease. There's not a response with this agent of note, similar to regorafenib. However, the toxicity profile is very different. And so we see more myelosuppression as a toxicity of TAS-102 than we do with regorafenib. And there's a less of fatigue and nausea with the agent.
Can you talk a little bit more about exactly what it is and how it works? I know there are two agents in the agent.
Correct. It is similar to 5-FU, but has mechanisms of action that do subtly differ. It is a combination of two agents, one that actually blocks the metabolism and preferentially encourages the anti-tumor activity of this agent. It is an agent that has been under development for many years and has come out of really work understanding how 5-FU is metabolized, how it interacts with both DNA and RNA. And this is felt to be a little more DNA specific than the combined DNA-RNA effects of 5-FU.
If TAS-102 does become available, how will you sequence it and how would it fit in with regorafenib?
So it's a great question. If it is approved, it's anticipated to have a label that would look very similar to regorafenib, which will give clinicians the opportunities we anticipate to choose either for their patients. I think there is, unfortunately, a lack of biomarkers for either agent. And so we're really kind of left with understanding the toxicity profile of these two. Certainly, it will take a bit of time for clinicians to get used to the TAS-102, how to dose that. The dosing is a little more complex than the regorafenib, but certainly very manageable for patients. My practice, I suspect, will be based on the side effect profile. We hope to be able to offer both agents to all patients at some point in their disease course. But I think for patients who have really been struggling with the fatigue, the nausea and vomiting of a prior second-line regimen, the opportunity to have an oral agent that does not have those side effect profiles, I think will probably result in our practice using more TAS-102 before regorafenib.
So as you mentioned, this course of this patient, unfortunately, is similar to what is often seen when the drug like regorafenib is used very late line. Is there any interest in moving it up earlier? Are there trials looking at that? Are there any data right now using it earlier?
So there are efforts to look at that. It is a matter of finding the right dose and the safety to ensure that the side effects are manageable. I think the data right now is still in that early phase, trying to find the combinations and the right doses. Because of the side effect profile, it may be more difficult to bring it up earlier into other lines of therapy, but we'll have to see how that data matures.
So I'm always curious whether people have actually observed any benefit in using regorafenib in late line therapy. And you mentioned this 52-year-old man. I thought that was an interesting, different path. What happened with him?
No, absolutely. And I think it's an important recognition that there are indeed some patients that can have prolonged disease control and clear benefit with the agent. So in this particular gentleman, was a 52-year-old man with metastatic colorectal cancer. He had fairly extensive liver involvement, low-volume lung nodules, and he had a nearly obstructing bleeding rectal primary in place. About a 20-25 pound weight loss over the 2 months prior to his diagnosis. So he presented, we initiated FOLFOX for 2 months with a mixed response that favored progression. We did not include bevacizumab because he had a very tight rectal primary that we were watching, and because of his overall performance status, did not think that he would tolerate time off of therapy in order to do radiation or resection. He had, again, a mixed response, and given that mixed response, we added in irinotecan after several doses of receiving a FOLFOXIRI regimen. Fortunately, his rectal primary improved with that regimen. Had a brief stability of disease at first restaging, but then on the next restaging, had disease progressing in both lungs and liver. His performance status was borderline at that point, 2-3. And it was a situation where we had kind of a long discussion about hospice versus, at that point, which was a fairly new agent, regorafenib, that had just been approved. After those discussions, we opted to proceed with regorafenib. He received the 120 milligram daily dose And that was started back in December of 2012. And he actually had a remarkable clinical improvement. His cachexia resolved, he gained weight back. He had restaging that demonstrated a morphologic response, so this kind of anti-angiogenic response, remembering that this is a patient who had not received a anti-angiogenic agent before. And in his case, had a near PR by measurement.
You mentioned the cystic changes that are sometimes seen with response to anti-angiogenics. Did he have that?
So he did. He had a nice morphologic response, cystic response, where you have a very heterogeneous tumor with a lot of early enhancement, especially in the arterial phase, if you're doing a triple phase CT scan of the liver. And with treatment, he had more homogeneous, lower density tumor with a very kind of sharp margins around the tumor edge without that kind of enhancement on the early arterial phase. So very kind of classic morphologic response.
Is this like a necrosis phenomena or what's going on?
So the studies that we've done have shown that that's very tightly correlated with a pathologic response. But we also know that a lot of that enhancement, the heterogeneity that one sees on the CT scan is really driven by the degree of vascularity. And so we think a lot of those changes are really a reflection of the anti-angiogenic activity of the agent.
Do you ever see bleeds?
So we don't. Very, very rare to see any kind of microscopic bleeding within the tumor.
So what happened after that?
So he did very well. His performance status returned to absolute zero as he was asymptomatic with it. And he was able to continue therapy for over 2.5 years.
Wow.
It required dose modulation given his toxicities over the year. But this is a remarkable case in somebody who had clearly progressed on FOLFOXIRI chemotherapy from the start. Unfortunately, he did progress, and we had tried additional rechallenges of other chemotherapies, returning back to some of the regimens in combination with other antigenics, including some of the ones we discussed before. And unfortunately, none of those worked, and he then progressed and is now under hospice care.
Any hypotheses biologically about why you would see something like this?
So in this case, we had performed some sequencing to try to understand, but I think we have a very strong signal here with the morphologic changes that we see. The question is, was there a driver mutation that he was particularly sensitive to? But I think in this case, he had a tumor that was very responsive to an anti-angiogenic inhibition. My sense is that's probably the most likely hypothesis for his benefit.
I mean, maybe in other patients, they've already gotten Bev, and something happens to the tumor. This man never had Bev. You know, do you think, I don't even know if that's been looked at, do patients who have not had Bev do better with regorafenib?
Yeah, it's a great question, and certainly this case raises that hypothesis, as you mentioned. I think there's have not been that many patients in the studies that have gone on that they've been able to really tease that out, but it certainly does suggest that if this is a regimen that could be combined safely with chemotherapy, perhaps as a first anti-angiogenic therapy, there could be potential, but it's really limited, I think, in how it can be combined given the toxicity profile.
It's really amazing. You think about, you were about, you know, thinking about hospice, and then this man gets 2.5 years on an oral agent. That's incredible. I want to ask you about some other sort of new developments in the field. And one we saw at the ASCO meeting that was a real surprise to me, which was the use of trastuzumab and lapatinib in HER2-positive metastatic colorectal cancer. I didn't even know there was such a thing as HER2-positive colorectal cancer. And when I first heard about it, I thought they were talking about gastric cancer, but this was colon cancer. So can you talk about what was looked at there?
No, absolutely. So this was a very nice study that really reflected a huge amount of work by the European investigators. And what has been known for several years that there are HER2-amplified colorectal cancer patients, that perhaps about 4 to 5% of patients. These tend to be enriched in patients that have no KRAS or NRAS mutation, which actually is reassuring from the biology that this could be a driver event. And in these patients, the study here looked at the combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib, kind of a dual combination that really effectively blocks the ERB family, especially HER2. And the combination had very nice response rates in the mid-30% response. with the therapy, really demonstrating for the first time that, you know, effective blockade of HER2 in colon cancer can provide benefit in a larger study. Now, this is interesting because historically, this is something that cooperative groups in the U.S. had studied a few years back, more than 10 years ago, with an irinotecan trastuzumab study, where they actually saw activity. They had 7 patients treated, and 4 of them had a response in kind of a second-line setting. But this is really back before the field was ready to delve into these very low prevalent subgroups. And this understanding then was, well, this is not worth pursuing because the biomarker prevalence is less than 25%. And certainly we're in a different era now where we're willing to chase these 1, 2, 3% subgroups.
And particularly in a common cancer like colorectal cancer. And I guess this is like breast cancer, it's amplification, it's not mutation in HER2?
Correct. So it is indeed a high amplification. There are, just like breast cancer and gastric cancer, correlations with immunohistochemistry. And there are screening efforts that are being discussed for the next studies to explore this, where the recognition that you can get a good first approximation of what patients may have for HER2 amplification based on the IHC alone.
So we talked about the fact that now MSI testing is certainly critical in metastatic colorectal cancer. What about HER2 testing at this point?
It's a great consideration. It is something that we certainly have the proof of concept for. I think there is a number of studies that are enrolling HER2 amplified colorectal cancer patients. Many of the panel assays, panel mutation testing that we're doing now, are starting to incorporate these amplification events. And so my hope is that as the biomarker screening platforms evolve and the assays are then able to both to call both mutations but also amplifications out of these panels, that will be much more efficient in identifying these patients and getting them on appropriate targeted therapy.
I'm curious, a number of times during this chat, you've talked about driver mutations and genomic testing, and I see you were part of a big paper from your institution in the JNCI, a decision support framework for genomically informed investigational cancer therapy. What were you trying to get at with this paper, and how does that specifically relate to colorectal cancer in your purview?
So this is really recognizing that making use of precision oncology, personalized oncology, really has several pillars. Certainly there's the understanding that we have to have therapies that target particular molecular alterations. It's critical to have those clinical trials to move forward. But we're increasingly operating in a world where we're not just testing KRAS codons 12 and 13, that we're testing huge panels of genes, sequencing the entirety of the genes in some region. And there is a huge clinical need to help support the clinicians that are trying to interpret this and get this information turned into action for the patients. How do we actually take this complex report, decipher it, identify the right study, and get them on? And increasingly, we're at a point where this is something that we should not be requiring the clinician to do, that this is something that support needs to be provided. And so I think part of the effort we have at MD Anderson is really trying to bridge that gap between that multi-gene assay and the clinical trials, is really trying to understand, does this mutation make sense? Just because there's a mutation doesn't mean that this is actually turning on the gene. It doesn't mean that there's any potential for benefit with the agent. A good example is the BRAF story, the BRAF V600E, clear activating mutation. If you see that in many tumor types, there are studies that make a lot of sense in where activity can be found. But a mutation in 594, one of the second or third most common, turns out to be an inactivating mutation in BRAF. And so when you see that mutation, your first instinct is to say, gosh, I need to get that patient onto a clinical trial with a BRAF inhibitor. Well, that would actually not be the best approach because BRAF has already been turned off by this mutation. And so that is an important missing piece right now in our management of patients with any tumor type, is interpreting this wealth of information that is coming out of the sequencing.